Today, my guest is Mr. Scott Ricard. He is a former U.S. intelligence officer, a linguist, and he's also worked for a number of different alphabet agencies. We are going to start by explaining some of the aspects behind the collapse of the Soviet Union and the oligarchs, and then expand that into the plutocratic system across the board and how these different players, banks, and governments work together for their own personal ideologies and profits. All right, and so that's Mr. Scott Ricard. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ryan.
Привет, как дела? Богатые юрики, каждый страны.
That's funny.
Wait, I do want to talk about Russia, though, or the Soviet Union, because I do see a lot of missing history with all this dialogue about Ukraine and what's going on there. I hear a lot of people trying to talk about it who really don't understand recent Russian history since the collapse of the Soviet Union, or why that happened. The kind of narrative I'm often fed if I do ask is, oh, well, they got an arms race with Reagan and they lost.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's sad. But that's
it
it's
is.
It's kind of, as we were talking about earlier, about World War I and II, they say the Germans started those wars, and it wasn't clean like that. But
it never is.
There's no mention of the oligarchs, and there's mention now when people say the oligarchs, you know, this oligarch or that oligarch, and I'm saying, no, they don't know. They don't know what you're talking about. So I'd like to talk about the transition from the communist Soviet Union over to the oligarchs and how that went down, the voucher system, the fake auctions, and so on. And we're going to have to talk about Boris Berezovsky, especially. He's one of the central oligarchs. But let's start with the collapse in the 90s. Why did the Soviet Union really collapse? I know it's a huge question, but let's get it started. What happened to the Soviet Union? They were one of the strongest or second strongest empire in the world, and suddenly there's a collapse.
Well, you know, to say that they were the second strongest empire, you know, obviously, you know, the Soviet Union has been extremely good at dealing with the steel and the metals industries. You know, they're leaders in the world today. They've always been leaders in the world in the rich metals, as well as in the petroleum space. So, you know, that's been something that has been, a dominant player in most of the leaders across the planet. Now, being able to manipulate any kind of market when it comes to those, steel industries, and as well as any kind of, you know, industrial age advancements that we've gone into. So, you know, that being said, you know, the Russians have had extreme success, considering the fact that they've been the target of the West, you know, in the last century, a minimum of at least three times. And, you know, that's basically taking the Bolshevik War and rolling that into World War One, because they were sort of synonymous when you look at the progression of that time period. They weren't very far apart. And then obviously World War Two, and then, you know, there were other periods that were sort of low periods, unfortunately, for not just the Soviets, but also throughout the West as well, because everybody was recovering from those wars. But the real, kick in the gut for the Soviets was, in the 80s. And some of it had to do with expenditure on military infrastructure, but a lot of it had to do really with the move of the not only the oligarchs, but also the mafia. The mafia was operating pretty extensively outside of Russia. And so you had, I always use this guy because he is the most powerful and most unknown mafia guy in the history, not just of Russia, but of the planet. Mogilevich was very instrumental in working with both MI6 and CIA folks, basically informing the Americans about the operations within the Soviet Union at the time. And then obviously they had the Jamestown Foundation that was working very effectively at turning Soviet KGB agents. And those agents were the ones that were basically informing the CIA of who the oligarchs were that they should turn to, because these people had already made the choice that they were going to turn on the Soviet Union, even prior to the perestroika sort of glasnost period that really was the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union, that really brought down the Soviet Union. The war was just a result of the timing, and a lot of people were pretty much tired of living under communism, because communism was, it was way too overbearing on the folks that were actually producing, and obviously if you are fighting just to keep what you make and you're dealing with a society, it was corrupt, obviously, so there were a lot of there was a lot of bad blood between the people that were in the Politburo and the people who were in the business side, who were becoming more associated, very similar to the situation we see in Ukraine, more associated with Western business practices. So, a lot of that has changed. We're talking, 20 plus years since the fall of the Soviet Union. So, today's Russia is nothing like, the Soviet Union from the 80s. And the oligarchs, they pilfered, especially once the green light was given on. What I think unfortunately happened to Russia is that, I don't know if this was by design, but certainly much like, let's just use Barack Obama as an example. This guy, Mikhail Gorbachev, was a very similar type of leader. He's well-liked, but he didn't know what questions to ask. He didn't know where the bodies were buried. He didn't have the same, sort of keen understanding like, say, H.W. Bush did, or say Putin does. So these are the kinds, and not that every time a leader runs a country, but obviously a leader can be easily taken advantage of, very much like Barack Obama is, and Bush Jr. was, by their by the people that they surround them with, and by the people that they leave behind. I mean, Boris Yeltsin was a buffoon. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Boris Yeltsin was probably more like George Bush Jr. He was, he was just a total buffoon. Well, yeah, better. Yeah, that's actually, Joe Biden would be better, because I can't stand that guy.
And he's a drunk too, but I mean, yeah. He was in and out of the hospital for a year, and you had Yegor Gaidar, the prime minister, controlling a lot of things, and he was ideologically in tune with a lot of these oligarchs.
Yeah, he was definitely in tune with the oligarchs, and he made, he made a lot of, situations very easy for the West to move in. There's, a lot of businesses came in and just when they saw things were going south, and they saw the actual economies were failing, as much as just around the turn of the late 90s, everybody was just selling off everything, moving money offshore, and they basically bankrupt for the second time. That's why Khodorkovsky went to jail. They bankrupt for a second.
We had to explain who Khodorkovsky is first.
Oh, yeah. So Yukos Oil, right? So here they create this great oil find out in Siberia and create essentially what is going to be the next major oil infrastructure in Russia. And it was a good business, obviously. It was very prosperous. But the state, they weren't paying their taxes, and the state was like, look, enough is enough. And they realized that, the West was basically fleecing the finances, because a lot of the stock was being sold off, And as people were selling off the stock, they were moving money offshore to the Cayman Islands. And this was a big deal because this was
in Cyprus and the Cayman.
Cyprus. And you also had folks in even Isle of Man. A lot of money went to the British Empire. And then you also had stuff even going to the British Virgin Islands. So that kind of float of cash was probably the death of I'd say the you know, they had a lot of folks that were defecting that were alongside Yukos that still even today live in Israel, basically in exile. These guys are, you know, what I call the they were the mafia, the Zionist mafia in Russia that was working hand in hand with the Zionist mafia of the West. So these guys had, you know, major success at fleecing the entire, you know, wealth of, you know, these entire, you know, but not just the oil business, but there was all kinds of businesses. There was, you know, it was predominantly oil, but steel and, you know, metals, heavy, you know, precious metals. And these guys were, you know, they were building up empires, you know, where they had, you know, not considered the richest people in the world, but billions of dollars. And for Russians at the time, you know, that was quite a feat, you know, in there. And a lot of these guys, you know, kept their money in, you know, places like Zurich, and then, you know, went into Israel and started to do their same corruption down there. And the Tel Aviv wanted nothing to do with these guys. But I think what's happening today, I have no confirmation of this, but I think what's happened today, because these guys were so instrumental in, and the kind of guys I'm talking about, were the folks that made it into Israel, that basically came out of you know, like private bank. I think one of the guy's names was Kolomolsky. He was like a co-founder of one of the largest banks, and it was an oil company bank. And these guys were, you know, the guys that were going against Gazprom's bank, and they were building up and they were the friends of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and he was the only guy that really had to go to prison.
Google up faces in the snow,
yeah,
and see that car chase and that whole ending of that.
It was ending of that time.
I would call it, yeah.
But these guys had a whole.
These guys got the money because it wasn't just, you know, rolling up their sleeves and working hard. These guys swindled
the money. They swindled the money. These guys came in with financiers and bankers and basically built it up and put it into a false I guess investment corporations, and they put like different names around them. You know, they had like one of them was called some kind of a Eurasian like resources corp, or maybe National Resources Corp or something like that. They had all these different like mining companies that they put up around, but what they were doing is they were creating a kind of like Enron. They were creating these trading companies and these basically false markets. And they were just Ponzi schemes. And when they got
the auctions, the normal
they rigged
process,
the auctions for, yeah, the sales of the companies, just like they were selling off stocks out of NASDAQ, you know, or out of New York Stock Exchange. And they created these sort of, you know, sort of promenades for these giant investors to come in. And, you know, a lot of people lost their shirts, you know, but at the same time, a lot of people, you know, knew the inside of the game. And knew when, you know, the literal, you know, fan was going to get hit. So that's really.
Khodorkovsky of Sibneff arranged for himself to be in charge of the process in which they processed applications for the bidding process.
And so
he just, for any technicality or another, pushed everyone out of the bidding process before there was even a bid. So rather than venture capitalists taking over industries and steel, media, what have you,
and he had already had it all set up. That's true.
He completely pushed them out, and then he and Khodorkovsky just bid against each other, extremely low, less than pennies on the dollar, and walked away with these major industries. And
And then they took, then they basically, they basically dumped it when it went off, when it went up, and they took all the money after they dumped their portion of it. And that's, I was surprised to see, and they did it alongside of, you know, Jacob Rothschild. I mean, he was one of their key outside players in England.
And Boris just went and lived in the UK. And that will dovetail into the Litvinenko scandal and the apartment bombings and everything else, all the propaganda coming out of Boris Berezovsky blaming everything on the KGB and Putin, etc.
Right.
Neither of whom are happy little campers or anything, but he was just well known for his fairy tales and giant conspiracies he could weave. But he had Yeltsin's ear. He had him completely convinced, taking advantage of a paranoid drunk. And was just a war.
Well, he also owned the media too, so that helped him. He owned Channel One.
He had ORT.
Which
he acquired through murder.
Yeah, so that was really where his play. You know, it's kind of the same play they do against the Americans. When you own the media, you know, you own the minds. And I got to tell you, Yeltsin. I mean, that guy. You know, he couldn't punch his way out of a paper bag. So he just didn't have the he was way outclassed, and I think that's the reason that he was, you know, put in that position. I think that's what happens in countries like this, like the United States as well. You know, they're these individuals, by the time the voters get to vote, they've already been vetted. They already know they've got the right kind of person. They know what the answers and the inabilities are of their puppets.
Yeah, could John McCain run twice?
Exactly. John McCain would be a perfect example of a Yeltsin. You know, for God's sakes, they had Sarah Palin as a vice president. You couldn't have picked two more incompetent people to run the country.
That'll scare you into voting for Obama.
I was forced to like support Obama, for God's sakes. At least he had some potential. You know, I mean, the issue is that, you know, the more indoctrinated you are, the more dangerous you are, and you know, to the sovereignty and to the sanity of the nation. And
McCain's and family itself goes right back to little mobsters too.
Meyer Lansky, you know, hired his father-in-law. You know, so you know, you had he was working for basically the whole liquor gang that ran what's her name? His wife Cynthia's maiden name, the Bronfen family, Seagram's. The whole Seagram's industry was run by and the distribution was being taken care of by Cynthia's dad. Before, and then he basically was a yes man for the Jewish mafia in the United States that built Vegas, that you know, owned the liquor business in the West, still does, and the whole
McCain's father helped cover up the, well, not just help.
Oh, McCain's father himself too. Well, yeah, I think McCain's father did it for different reasons. The real kingpin in that was probably Lyndon Johnson. You know, the Lyndon Johnson was a whore for the Zionists, and his whole sort of agenda was really a number, you know, a number on the United States from a perspective of, you know, misinformation. You know, everybody that worked for him is still basically the founders of PNAC. You had John McCain, his dad obviously, but you also had Rumsfeld work for him. Just Dick Cheney worked for Lyndon Johnson. So, you know, the same kinds of things, unfortunately, that were happening in the United States, you know, kind of started to happen. I think
with Lee Hamilton to investigate Iran-Contra.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you talk about the fox in the henhouse. So that same thing was happening in Russia, but I think it wasn't happening, or Soviet Union at the time. I don't think it really happened in the Soviet Union until probably about 10 to 15 years after it started happening more seriously in the United States. You know, in the early 50s, I would say it was moving in a kind of an interesting direction because of the influence from the Third Reich on the United States, because it had a pretty interesting effect because of the kinds of intel guys, the kind of scientist guys, the kind of really educators that came into the U.S. Sort of mind share versus comparatively to, let's say, the corruption from the early 1900s. It was more along the financial side. And then that combined in the 60s, I think, with the real push of the Zionists to, get it directly involved in the media, get directly involved in the politics, and really go after it with these just, I mean, you couldn't do enough shows to cover the amount of organizations that are working in concert. You know, even for Khodorkovsky's guy, there's a group out of New York that is a Khodorkovsky gang. They're called the Institute for Modern Russia. I don't know if you've seen these guys, but these guys are basically a mouthpiece for the oligarchs that have basically offshored all the finance. And I'm very sure that Russia's aware of it, because as soon as I started to...
You should mention he's out of jail now and
yes,
working feverishly.
He's in Zurich with all his hedge fund buddies. You know, I'm sure he got a nice big open, blank checkbook saying, you're back in business. Let's see what we can do for you. And, any assets that he had, slid out somewhere, I'm sure that they came flying right back in. And, the same guys in the U.S. side are working with these, all the guys that got caught, hiding money in Switzerland. I don't know if you're familiar with Bradley Bilkenberg. He was one of the guys that blew the whistle on UBS. He got out of prison last year in September and or in August, and in September, because of his case, and he turned state's evidence. He ended up, he served a short period of time, a year or so. But he ended up getting paid by the IRS $104 million. So here you are, you come out as a whistleblower for UBS, you get your $104 million check, and then his boss also got a payout. He just was in prison. What's his name? Ryel. He was just in prison down in Fort Lauderdale. He spent a short period down there. He served a... he was in, I guess, in front of the judge. I don't know what the outcome of that was, but he's already back in Zurich as well. And these are two huge players in UBS that were very involved in, this entire sort of money laundering for not just drug lords, but also for, paying off, no doubt paying off individuals who were involved in terrorism. These guys are funding terrorism because you don't have an enemy for the military-industrial complex, because nobody else has the money to fund them. So the West funds this damn terrorism in order to, create their boogeyman, and now they've got somebody to fight, which kind of looks like Ukraine to me.
I call them the new privateers.
Yeah, I mean, the Russians are chomping at the bit. The West is chomping at the bit, and unfortunately, I think the Russians are just as tied to this, this financial debacle, as well as this military-industrial complex as the West. They are not as big of players, but they realize that they have to play ball in order to compete. I was looking through something the other day. I think I talked to you about this, and it kind of fits in that oligarch play as well. I stumbled across a guy who was basically involved in this this whole I guess, what do you call it? It's that whole sort of modern Russia component, where I was doing some research on the folks involved in Russian media. And I came across, I don't know if you've ever seen this, the Kommersant media group. It's a really pro-Israel Zionist broadcast group that's tied back to all these German Marshall Fund guys, the Royal Institute of International Affairs type, the Center for Strategic and International Studies type, obviously the Council on Foreign Relations. But it's basically a pro-Israel Russian media outlet. And that kind of tied me into, you know, because these guys, they're tied into Hordakovsky's game, and they're also tied into, you know, what I considered a, you know, a gold mine of financial infrastructure when you go into guys like Igor Kostikov. Now, this guy Kostikov is what I would consider a kingpin of the oligarch financial community. He's on the board of a company called the Eurasian Private Equity Group. Well, this group is based out of Cyprus, but this guy is so powerful in Russia, and he's very pro-Israel. But he sits on the board of the Information and Telegraph Agency in Russia, the ITAR-TASS. Well,
he's the chairman of the Russian Security and Corporate Governance Institute.
Yeah, I mean, but this guy is also tied to everything that we're talking to that's extremely pro-Israel. It's extremely, tied to Western finance. For God's sakes, the guy's the head of the basically the FDIC of Russia, mm-hmm. You know, the Russian Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is their basically deposit insurance. So, you know, that came as a surprise to me because one of his partners in crime is a former U.S. Naval Intelligence guy, you know, and so you got U.S. Naval Intelligence who's tied in with this whole sort of Russian finance group that has fleeced Russia, and they're doing it right under, you know, Russia's nose. So it can't be a shadow, you know, thing going on here. There's no way that the FSB doesn't know these guys exist. You know, they got to know these guys. In fact, this guy I'm referring to, Jeff Latino,
Are you talking about Jeffrey Latino?
Yeah. So Jeff Latino, he's the guy. He runs all of the cloud for VGTRK, the second largest television network in Russia. And at the same time, he sits on the same board with Igor Kostikov, you know. So this is not a shadow government thing. You know, this is in your face. So it makes, you know, the rhetoric that you see in the news going back and forth seem just like kabuki theater. I mean, if they're allowing this stuff to happen in the background, you know, that comes as a shock to me. And I took this information and I stumbled across it and gave it back to the FSB in Washington, D.C., and needless to say, it's the last time they talk to me. You know, I think they're never going to, I'll never get another an interview on VGTRK. So, but that's the thing is that, you know, if you take the time to go look, you know, the tombstones for where the bodies are buried are very easy to find. But not everybody's willing to, you know, jump into these rabbit holes and, you know, burn a, you know, an entire, you know, 10-12 hour period doing research on something like this. So that's kind of, you know, the, you know, kind of a roundabout way, you know, to say that, you know, I think that the oligarchs are in cahoots with each other, you know, on all sides of the line here. And it's the political guys who have to kind of, you know, tiptoe around to figure out, okay, how much is it that I can do to try to help my people or to try to fleece my people, depending on what kind of leaders they are. So, and you know, I kind of see Putin as, you know, potentially aligning himself with the people once in a while. You know, he sort of looks after, you know, trying to say, look, I'm going to do the best I can. But, you know, his hands are tied. They've got to be tied as well. And think about it. This guy came out of some of the highest levels of intelligence. So, you know, you're no man is an island, you know. And so, you know, obviously, you know, I don't have.
He's responsible for throwing oligarchs in jail and exiling the rest of them. And a lot of them, they went to the UK or Israel because they don't have extradition treaties. And so they lived happily with their billions of dollars and started buying soccer teams and everything else. But
They've got soccer teams across the planet. Yeah.
But Putin is who pushed them out.
He is
a nationalist.
Yeah, he did push him out, and rightfully so. I mean, the same thing needs to happen in the United States. The same thing needs to happen in England. I mean, I've said for a long time, and I didn't.
We all have oligarchs.
We all have oligarchs.
It's a plutocracy, no doubt about
it. It's
horrific.
Yeah, it's worse than Russia was. Yeah. And they fleeced us. They're still fleecing us on a monthly basis. They call it quantitative easing. I mean, you talk about something you couldn't give a worse word. I mean, it might as well be barbed wire dildo is what it should be called. I hope I didn't offend anybody on your show.
I mean, that's government. I mean, there's no word you could think of that is more rotten than government.
Yeah, but
the oligarchs in the U.S. if it did it in a less theatrical way, rather than the shootings and the rigged auctions and things. It's just the normal process of the relations between business and state, where they get fat no bid contracts and lots of money from the government, and then they just use a portion of that to continue to bribe the government to get corporate favoritism and corporate welfare. I mean, all these financial guys got between them $16 trillion from the Fed in a secret bailout, plus the government's public bailout for what was essentially fraud. They bribed rating agencies to lie on their behalf, and I mean, all these people ought to be in jail.
Sure,
but they're getting bonuses and, you know, banging hookers and sniffing cocaine on their yachts. That's, you know, that's their life.
Well, there are some that did fall and did suffer from the failure. Obviously, they weren't the guys who had, you know, the best positions, you know, because there were a lot of folks that did lose their jobs. But these were, you know, mid-level managers and below.
Also, it helped further consolidate the monopolies because they allowed some to flounder, like Merrill Lynch and Countrywide, et cetera, and they got swallowed up by Bank of America.
Right.
And what you see is, they get a secret bailout and you don't.
Right.
So it's just a way of letting the competition hang itself while those engaged in the same kind of debauchery are getting bailed out from the Fed, which wasn't even public. And then they use their newfound money to buy up their previous competition and consolidate their wealth and power as monopolies.
Well, I think what's interesting to look at is that, you know, it's so poorly explained, and that, you know, obviously, you know, I was on Crosstalk recently, and he said, do you think Ukraine is a failed state? Well, I was like, no, I mean, if Ukraine's a failed state, then the United States is a failed state. I mean, we've basically gone into bankruptcy three times, and all we do to get out of it is we raise the debt ceiling, which means that we're just able to, like, you know, pull money out of thin air with our Federal Reserve, with basically all they're really doing is keeping the interest low, because the interest payments on the debt, you know, are somewhere in about $500 billion right now, just on the national debt. Not the commercial debt, because that's just incredibly crazy, but these sort of interest payments are the sort of the telltale that will bring down the American financial empire. So they're forced.
The Onion did a spoof piece saying they're, you know, funny guys, and they said FBI has discovered internal documents from Al Qaeda, where their plan is to sit back and watch the U.S. destroy itself.
Yeah, I mean, but we're
going that way. I mean, we've got 1 in 4 people are unemployed. If you look at the real unemployment numbers, not 3, which is completely bogus. And I hate that how they just create categories and invent statistics, but they do. You've got the government CPI numbers, which are just worthless.
Right. Well, the thing is when it comes to it's really become such a false narrative when you're talking about the real debt. I mean, a great example of that is if you look at the exposure for the banks and the amount of money that they're exposed to on their debt. Now, by the way, this is after 5, 6, 7 years almost of this quantitative easing programs. Now they're in their most heavy dosage state. They're at like $75 billion a month right now. But at the, you know, it's basically like putting somebody on antibiotics and having to increase it for 7 years, and they're still not cured. So you know, that ought to tell you something.
It's more like fighting off a hangover by just continuing to drink alcohol.
Yeah, that too. That's so,
you're but they're organ failure eventually. But like, yeah, well, and that's gonna have a hangover. You're just gonna have a heart attack, or liver's gonna break, or whatever.
But the exposure of, let's take, you know, a really sickening example, like the net worth of the worst player in this is Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs has, you know, somewhere around $40 billion net worth. It's horrifically low, comparatively to say like a perhaps a you know, Citibank or Wells Fargo, a couple of the biggest. It's about a tenth of theirs, but they have this same exposure to debt as Citibank or as the you know, per their. Their size, they have the same exposure, yet they have a tenth of the assets, and yet they were still allowed to survive when they let companies like Lehman go by the wayside, and you know, sadly, you know, the first people to get paid when AIG, which by the way, they had to save AIG. Most people don't know the history of AIG and what a real pinnacle of the American oligarchs that is. AIG, Marsh McLennan, that whole sort of conglomerate was founded mostly during the wealth came mostly during World War II. Most of their customers were in Japan and China and across Europe. And when the Americans were looking to go to war, they didn't really have a whole lot of intel. We didn't have a lot of international intelligence. Prior to World War II, you know, we were really dependent on the British, the French, and AIG actually had a lot of information, a lot of the businesses that they'd sold policies to, because most of their business was overseas business. So a lot of those folks were providing the intel to the American military infrastructure. And then post-World War II, they became the Black Bank. Those were the guys that were basically handling funds, you know, for the OSS.
Their offices were hit in the World Trade Centers on 9/11, which is mm-hmm. where the plane went into. And a lot
yeah,
of
and Goldman Sachs was 15 floors of that second building too, all up on the top. So yeah, those guys, they had the you know, if you talk about somebody that knew where all the bodies were buried with the CIA funds. You know, these giant sort of offshore, you know, that was why you saw AIG being one of the first ones paid out of the gate when everything, when the literal failure happened in 2008. Because without that, you were basically not able to fund a lot of these sort of covert operations that were, you know, this is money that is unaccountable. It is not. Nobody's ever allowed to even look behind the curtain. You know, these are the places that the bodies are been buried since World War II. You know, when they were creating all these great programs to, you know, operate clandestine. And one of the cool things that came out in 2010 that was awesome. I mean, I was so glad to get this information because I'd learned so many things from it. When the Mossad murdered Mahmoud al-Mabouh in Dubai, they put out such good information. The police and the amount of details that were put out on these assassins was just tremendous. So it tied back
footage of them all around the hotel.
Oh, they had their passports. They had video footage. They told where the credit cards
they had. Yeah,
they had information on where the credit cards were being handled. The prepaid credit card companies they used. Well, there was enough information that if you went down the rabbit hole, and I did, I mean, I was interested in this to the nth degree because I'd never seen that kind of public information provided around a an assassination. And the UAE went out of their way to provide some extremely detailed information. So it tied back into Malta, banks in Malta operating that were basically clearing the credit cards out of New Jersey with a company called IDG. I don't know if you've ever heard of these guys. IDG is a super heavy Zionist telecommunications and banking company, operates out of New Jersey, but was founded by a kid that grew up in Brooklyn. And then the other one was a company called MetaBank. And the reason I like to bring these up, because it does fit into this oligarch game, MetaBank was clearing cash alongside IDG for these prepaid credit cards that the Mossad were using. And these banks had direct ties into Malta and into Switzerland, and they had clearing houses so that companies like AIG and companies like Private Bank and companies like Bank of Israel could basically put funds into Swiss banks that could be cleared through credit cards that were prepaid, so that basically as these operatives were moving around the planet, they could basically use credit cards to operate and get their, nobody could track them back to, specific countries and specific banks. Because once again, these clearing houses, those particular transactions aren't open to the public. And what was really interesting about the bank...
Similar to the DTCC, which was a clearing house for all the naked shorts and those attacks. And you would think... Why can't we look and see, who these people are? And they won't hand over the information to anybody.
Oh, no way. So this the really interesting one is this one, MetaBank. MetaBank operates out of the central part of the United States, headquartered out of Iowa. And it's run by a lot of these, really Pentecostal, super religious Zionists, very much... The Mike Huckabee style Zionist, they've all been to Israel, 2 to 3 dozen times, and they're constantly, pushing the Zionist referendum in the political empire, the Zionist political empire in the United States. And those are the kind of people that control this bank in Iowa, MetaBank. And what's interesting is that they're also tied into the agricultural business. These are the people who have received over $30 billion in public funding for the false market, for this the only people on the planet that are using corn for ethanol. Here we are taking perfectly good food, not only modifying it with, genetically modifying it to make it into less healthy and more productive into gas, insane. It's just one of the most insane things that a human could do. You're taking...
It's also like a 1 to 1.1 ratio. There's no return.
It is. But it was the oligarchs in the United States working alongside, the petroleum oligarchs, because, what does it take to create this entire infrastructure? You're still moving it around the same way. You're still, trucks are moving this stuff around. Those trucks aren't running on ethanol. Those trucks are running on diesel. Everybody that's in the same business today profited from, those vehicles that are harvesting that corn. They're not operating on ethanol. They're operating on fuel. They're operating on the same.
Actual conversion into ethanol.
There is no conversion, and comparatively to say sugarcane that Brazil uses, sugarcane is a 4 to 1 ratio pound for pound, but how much more sugarcane you can grow on the same square footage that you can grow corn, so it's a night and day difference. If you really wanted to use a product to create ethanol, sugar cane is the only product to use. But the only people on the planet using corn are the Americans because of this whole oligarch mentality, whereby
also you've got the big block of Midwest senators that are they're just pro corn syrup. I mean, they're the corn syrup gang. But
oh, sure,
agribusiness is a medium to funnel money into other industries like big pharma, etc., because they use money from farm subsidies. A lot of that money is going to pay for pesticides and steroids, antibiotics, and all these drugs and things involved in farming and ranching. But the prices for those are much higher than they would be on the market because they know that it's coming from subsidies. And so it's a way of indirectly subsidizing these other industries.
Absolutely.
Through the untouchable
well, that's the same
area of agriculture, because the Senate, there are enough senators when you add them up from the West that they have a block where they're never going to touch farm subsidies. And so as long as you can associate or attach yourself into that business gambit, you're protected and your subsidies will keep coming as well.
Well, they finally shut off the ethanol subsidies. But these guys have just basically so dramatically profited. And, you know, obviously, if you mandate 10% of the gas tank, I mean, that's 2 million barrels a day of basically equivalent, because Americans consume about 20 million barrels of oil.
To the public, like, look, we're going to do something green.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with being green. It has everything to do with these guys. And they're the same guys who are in the banking community, the agri community, the intelligence community. So sad, the irony of this, so sad. One of the key players at MetaBank, he was a key player also at the agricultural department under George Bush Jr., G.W. Bush. George Walker Bush had him as a senior executive on the agricultural department when the mandate came out to put 10% ethanol in the American's tank. And this guy sits on the board of MetaBank. And the irony of this guy's name, his name is E. Thurman. And no lie, I mean, this is ridiculous. His last name is Gaskill. I swear to God. I mean, and I found that guy because I went down the rabbit hole of who the hell is clearing these banks and clearing these finances for these Mossad guys that murdered Mahmoud El Mabua in Dubai. And I found E. Thurman Gaskill tied into this whole ethanol debacle, tied into these banking clearing for these oligarchs that are stealing and hiding money and moving around. I listed every single bank that they were tied to. And after it all came out and after I put it all and published it all over the place, all that information on all those websites went away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, PNAC's gone too.
Yeah, no, they're very...
Papers are gone now.
I did the same thing to, there was another oligarch who was working very closely alongside the Russian mob, laundering money for Semyon Mogilevich, buying off Japanese and Filipino and Philippine and also Taiwan, Indonesian, no matter who the political individuals were. Nicholas Deak was buying them off, and Nicholas Deak got his start as a Hungarian oligarch that left Hungary just before World War II, came to the United States. He was a very well-connected banker in Hungary, and he also was very closely tied to Semyon Mogilevich, who ended up buying up a lot of the arms dealers in Hungary after the fall of the Iron Curtain. In the 80s. So you had...
I gotta also mention there was a massive black market for Russian weapons when the Soviet Union fell. They were selling tanks and everything else to anybody.
That's right. And that's where Mogilevich came in, and he was...
Yeah, you need these people to launder the money, and you need these banks to help with these purchases. All black market, though.
And what was interesting, there was so much money that nobody wanted to deal in currency because it was messing with the currency market. And that's when they created the Krugerrand, because the metals guys, the same oligarchs we're talking about, all these guys in the precious metal game thought, let's trade in metals. So they created the Krugerrand, with the South African puppet government that was, you know, rightfully thrown out of place. It was basically Israel too. And this particular...
Israel was the only country not to participate in,
yeah.
in blockading or in the embargo against the apartheid, clearly yeah. apartheid regime.
Clearly.
They continued... Actually, they made a pretty penny on that because with South Africa not any longer having any one to sell to, Israel ended up with a lot of their diamonds.
Yeah. No, so they
because there was no competition.
Well, they were already tied into the diamonds through the Belgian and the U.S. markets. I mean, they'd had cornered the market on that well before that. But yeah, that's the kind of unfortunate, when you talk about oligarchs, you have so many to choose from, and this is only going back. And this led up to the fall of the Soviet Union, because what had happened,
I'd like to just kind of stress how this is a result of what happens when you have sanctions too. And I'm not saying you shouldn't have sanctioned South Africa, screw them, but it's something you have to watch out for. When you start slapping sanctions around, you actually create massive black markets, because they're still going to have to sell.
They'll still do what they're going to do. Yeah,
and so the mafia loves it.
The mafia loves it. Yeah, well, that's the thing. The mafia is like, are we going to have a war? Do I make my money that way? Or am I going to make my money black marketing the products again? Which is, they're like, I don't care. Just hurry up and decide, because I want to make, they want to make business decisions too. And that's, everybody's kind of, there is a consideration of a war. And the Soviets obviously don't want it, because it's a war that they'll never win. And or the Russians, I should say, don't want it. Certainly, the only people that are going to suffer are going to be Ukraine. They'll turn it into another Syria. There's no shortage of individuals who want revenge against the Russians. They'll find plenty of people across Chechnya and Afghanistan, and they'll have no trouble recruiting folks that will be happy to go against the Russians. That's the problem, is that you're not dealing with a highly educated, highly nourished sanely experienced society when you're going to recruit in those areas. These are people who all they've known is war, and they've had a tough time just feeding themselves. And water and food is, these guys aren't coming. You don't see a whole lot of fat, jihadists. There's these guys, unless they're the guys who are in charge. These guys are not.
I used to joke that's how you know who's in charge, is the fat guy.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's typically the guy who's had, 10, 15 years.
Arabian princes and stuff. Like...
Or the guys in the field. If you look at El Harati, Mahdi El Harati, he was the guy who ran forces for the Americans in Libya, in Syria, in Mali. People say that he's back in Syria now. I doubt it. He's probably just working in Turkey, being safe. That's that whole sort of gang. Mahdi El Harati has been working with the Americans for over 20 years, and he's probably the most knowledgeable about how to arm and recruit mercenaries for these CIA MI6 funded wars against places like Libya, Yemen, Syria, Iraq. And this guy has probably some of the best connections and probably the most loyal following of anybody. So, that thing I was trying to get into with the Krugerrand was Nicholas Deak. This guy, he came up through the ranks with William Casey, who basically ended up running the CIA. And he was very successful at laundering money, basically bribing political officials, selling equipment for McDonnell Douglas, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, you know, any American military manufacturer. He was on the front lines of bribing the government and then basically laundering money for people that were doing things like drugs.
And that's what it is. I mean, when you look at the aerospace companies, when they actually do bid on contracts, it's just a huge game of these guys bribing government officials for the government's money.
That's and they got great customers. Saudi Arabia is look at they just cracked the biggest deal with Saudi Arabia, $75 billion deal.
The F craps is what I call them, because the F-35 and 22, they don't really even really work, but they pawn them off on somebody, so they're going to Saudi Arabia, Okinawa, and places where they know they're not going to be used. So.
Well, what ends up happening is that they'll have, another obvious movement for Carlyle Group. They'll move right in. McKinsey and Company will drop right in to manage all the finances. And so this is their sort of modus operandi to, bring in the underlings and show them the tricks of the trade. And these intelligence guys come right alongside the defense contractors, and they have dual roles. You know, hey, we want you to come here and run this operation, but at the same time, we need details on how things are working
get leverage too, because Saudi Arabia doesn't even have enough pilots to fly those planes, but they bought them anyway. So it's as if it's saying, look, it's part of another deal. We're going to buy X number of these useless planes that cost $420 million a piece if you do X.
Well, that's like a Cadillac customer. You know, Saudi Arabia is a Cadillac customer. Even Libya at one point was a Cadillac customer. AECOM had won a $50 billion deal in 2007 with Gaddafi, and they were only bidding against the Chinese. And I think part of I'm pretty sure I'd never read this anywhere, but rumors and obviously results showed that they cut a deal with the Chinese, said, look, we'll take care of the project management and we'll take care of the logistics and the design, but the Chinese will get all of the actual labor and all of the actual fulfillment and sort of management, the maintenance sides. And what they were going to do is turn Libya into Dubai. The idea was to redo all of the civil engineering infrastructure, all the plumbing, all the electrical, new electrical grids, putting in, just a really extravagant coastline across the entire north of Libya. Now, it was about a 12-year project, and I think they got probably 3 or 4 years into it before Gaddafi was a drop in a bucket for him. He's like, this is only costing me $3 or $4 billion a year. Heck, I've got all kinds of reserves, I got no debt, you guys aren't really doing this for me. And he's like kind of toying with the West, and the West is like, hey, we're not gonna put up with this. You can't just treat us like, yesterday's garbage. We're the ones in charge here, for God's sakes. And he's like, look, I'm supplying a third of the oil to Europe. I've got tons of revenue. I put you out of business in Africa, and IMF is going, get rid of them, get rid of them, get rid of them. And so, it doesn't have anything to do with Washington. It doesn't have anything to do with, NATO. It has to do with the IMF. The IMF said, get rid of them. And everybody says, IMF said, get rid of them. I guess we got to get rid of them. So they're the ones that are calling the shots. So it's kind of the same thing with Ukraine. IMF is like, get rid of that puppet, put this puppet in place. What do you mean that puppet's not?
IMF's goal is to create as many banana republics as possible.
Well, not just in the. But look what's happening. In the last 10 years, the GDP for Ukraine has skyrocketed. Russia did some pretty good things. They had a small debt with Russia. Think about it. It's a pretty small debt. The debt with Russia was somewhere in the neighborhood about $15 billion. I think it's up to about $20 billion now with the gas prices. So it's not very much. And I think overall debt that they have as a country for 50 million people, by the way, it's quite small. I think it's in the neighborhood of about, I don't quote me on this, but it's less than half a trillion dollars. Let's just say it's 500 billion just for somewhere in that neighborhood. But at 500 billion, they're a sixth the size of the United States, right? And I think their GDP reached somewhere in the neighborhood of about only 200 billion. So let's just say it's double of their GDP. Okay, so the Americans are so supposedly at a one-to-one ratio, but you have to take into consideration the inflated nature of the financial markets that feed into that GDP for the United States, right? That's not all product. That's also a lot of, you know, bullshit feathers, you know, that you know, everything, people just basically passing around paper and calling it product. So, you know,
if you're lying about our inflation rate, and if you lie about inflation, then the numbers you get for GDP are wrong.
Exactly. So, but on a per capita income, or not even income, per capita, you know, person in individual debt, you're looking at a country that is, you know, the United States on just the national debt, by the way. I'm not even talking about the commercial debt, because that's just insane. That just blows it all out of the water. The national debt only is $50,000 for every man, woman, and child. Well, in Russia, it's only 10,000. So it's basically five times here, or not Russia, Ukraine. It's only five times here. So, you know, that it's not even equivalent. I mean, you can't say that Ukraine is a failed state. It's totally in debt. You know, they do the same thing with Greece. You know, Greece is a much smaller population with about the same amount of debt as Ukraine, unfortunately. They're up to about a half a billion, depending on how much they've forgiven recently. But they were thrown into the same trap that Ukraine's about ready to fall into. And you called it, you know, basically turning it into a third world, country.
Banana Republic, yeah.
Banana Republic, yeah. And what that is it, you know, it's just a place for people to go and play their Ponzi scheme, you know, on a smaller market. And then guess what you get when they fail? Hey, you get all their assets. Hey, well, you know, you got to pay us. Let's see. What do you got there? Those museums are pretty nice. You know, those hotels are pretty nice. So they basically can go in and, you know, say, well, we're going to pick up Park Place.
There's
we're going to pick
agricultural
up
agricultural land in the Ukraine that has intrinsic value.
Sure, no doubt. You know, food production is huge, you know, water, food, you know, and those, you know, the price that you pay for a bushel of you know, whatever, you know, product in Ukraine is worth, you know, anywhere, you know, even in the former Soviet states is worth three or four times. So when you start getting into, you know, the European states, that, you know, are, you know, even more expensive, you know, you're looking at paying four to five times for that same product. If you just, all you got to do is move it, you know, what, a few hundred miles. And now look, boom, now that I took something that I can only make, you know, 20 cents for, and now I can make a dollar, you know, so just by basically putting it on a, you know, on a truck, or putting it in a, so that's kind of the, like you say, the intrinsic value of food. You know, if you can get it moved right and get it produced right,
plus
and then
a lot
control.
Of these, players, Monsanto, et cetera, were moving into Ukraine and buying up grain elevators and all these things in ports prior to the coup d'etat.
Yeah, I imagine.
Yeah,
I mean,
what
it's
was gonna happen.
There's you know, you talk about the oligarchs in Ukraine. I mean, there's a boatload of, you know, just tremendously tied to the West, because obviously they've been far more anti-Russian, you know, for a number of reasons historically. And they've been tied to the Zionist movement. I mean, Zionism started in Odessa. And that's, you know, that's where, you know, the roots of, you know, there's not a lot of Jewish faith left in, Ukraine, especially after the late 90s, when there was easing, a lot of them left and went to Israel. You know, they had a huge influx of immigrants from Ukraine, in the late 90s, early 2000s, because they finally had eased the travel restrictions. So that was a, you know, a huge movement. And, you know, there's a lot of connections between the Zionists and the Ukraine. And I mean, the Western dominated Zionist, you know, governments are hugely proponents of this, you know, puppeteering, no matter who gets in, by the way. You know, I'm not saying that Timoshenko wasn't a puppet, or even Yushchenko or Yanukovych. They were all puppets to a degree. They all had to play and pay. They were paying their mafia friends who were very pro-Zionist. I mean, you know, Jesus, Mogilevich got his Israeli citizenship when he was kicked out of Moscow. You know, so here's a Ukrainian Jew who's running the Russian mafia, basically, gets kicked out of Moscow and goes to Israel and gets his Israeli passport, and then comes back in the Iron Curtain and takes over all the former Soviet arms manufacturers in Bulgaria, Romania, you know, and Hungary. And needless to say, he's got his hands full in Russia with the security business for the pipeline infrastructure, and also, you know, his connections with, you know, guys like what's the guy's name in Ukraine? He's like the richest guy in Ukraine, young kid. He's Tatar. I can always forget his name. Blonde haired, kind of blue eyed guy. I can't think of his name right now, but he's basically worth about $15 billion already. And I think he's sort of Mogilevich's protege. And he'll take over. Certainly in Ukraine, he'll take over.
Well, speaking of Zionists, look at Victoria Nuland's married to the founder of CNAC, Robert Kagan.
Yeah, Robert Kagan, for God's
sake. Robert Kagan, even more than Crystal, Robert Kagan peddled more lies about Iraq than any of them.
He's horrible. I mean, these guys, you know, what's the guy's, Cass Sustain's, wife is the spokesman for Obama now. What's her name? She does she's the redheaded girl that does the, she's got that, like, helmet cut, haircut. But, Jesus, man. Yeah, it's just ridiculous. It's nauseating. I mean, you know, and you can't have these kinds of conversations without people going, oh, you're anti-Semitic. I said, this has nothing to do with Judaism. This is a political movement that dominates the West. You know, this is a
country, and it's involved in conflicts, which conflicts are, they generate a lot of cash for a lot of industries.
And no, I love it when
religion is used a lot of times. It's like, well, if you can get people to fight each other, you get to sell a lot of guns, you get to do a lot of the.
Religion's always been used that way. Religion has consistently been used to manipulate societies. And that's what's happened with Zionism. They manipulated Christianity. They
I'm
manipulated
your king.
Judaism.
Why? In this book.
Yeah. They manipulated Judaism. They manipulated, Jesus, you even have atheists who have this, like, sort of robotic ideology. I use Dershowitz as an example. He's one of my favorites because he's just such a, you know, I'm pretty sure he's an atheist. He's said it several times.
Well, he's a Zionist.
Completely. He's a total Zionist, but
he's not. It's a weird thing for me because I think, like, Jewish atheist is an oxymoron because you either are or you're not, because even if you reject some of the more fantastical supernatural parts of the religion and you don't have a god or anything, they're still accepting the religious history, which is not actual history. Like, they accept the story of the, even though they
yeah,
it,
I think like, some okay, people, yeah, some people do cross
land,
that line.
We still lived here and we racially inherited. They still have this social Darwin style type of racism.
But I think they tie that more to ideological artifacts of historical events, rather than religious events. Yeah, now basically, you know, some
right,
people say you
I'm
can't separate the
a
two.
Lot of what they think were historical events were not there.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're buying into false history. Exactly. No, I totally agree with that. But they're not willing to do their own research. They've just accepted whatever, outcome of the education that they were, hand fed, and that's really the problem.
Well,
I've
Dershowitz
said.
is a great writer. He's one of the best plagiarists I've ever seen.
Yeah, I don't. You can attack him all day long. That guy's every dartboard should have every
He's a
dartboard
big
should have
arm.
his face on it. He should be replacing the target with his face. He's just the epitome of he's the antithesis of justice. However, recently he did do something really kind. There's some poor child that was being held against their will, the family's will, in some hospital. I can't remember the story exactly, but he went and said he would represent the family without cost because it was an atrocious medical decision by the hospital. And the family's like, no, we don't want to leave her here. And he said, you can't take her. And so he's defending the family for free, which
He
maybe
helped
you
try to
just.
defend Mike Tyson too.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
I mean, nobody is a completely total monster or a total saint. Well, besides John McCain, he's a monster, but nobody has every single aspect about him is bad. And it's a weird thing, like some of these Zionists who totally support ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and just still have no problem with murdering people or anything. They still go home and have wives and or husbands and kids to
Yeah,
take care of their kids.
they're, I
Same
mean,
with any group. I mean, even
well, that's.
neo-Nazis. I don't want to be. I just Goldenlawed myself, but a lot of these guys that were out there, killing people and everything at home, they're regular family people, and nobody. That's the thing. Like the cartoon idea of just someone who's just evil, totally to the core. They
That's what
compartmentalize it. They
propaganda
have
is for.
cognitive
That's how.
dissonance. They can be an absolute racist and a murderer and seem totally normal to their neighbors,
That's what propaganda is for. That's how Walt Disney got his money. He was creating little cartoon characters, making people look evil. So, and it's funny you brought up these are people too. Yeah, I mean, I think I sent you that link earlier this week with that documentary called The Gatekeepers.
Oh, yeah, Shin Bet.
I can't tell you how many times my jaw hit
You
the
got
desk
it.
watching
I
that thing.
recommend that to everybody, The
Oh my
Gatekeepers.
God, and that came out last year, right? That's a 2013 documentary, right?
Well, the end of it, yeah. End of
Yeah, that just
2013.
scared the living crap out of me. I was like, how the hell did we not get this information earlier? And it was these guys were basically saying the same thing you're saying.
I would rant about it, I'll just say, on my half.
But I
But now there's a
it's just
movie, and so.
it that documentary was just unbelievable how well it was done. And the Shin Bet I guess officers who spoke so candidly that they were ashamed. I mean, you could see that they felt like that they had done some really bad things, and the country had gone in a direction that they were just like, we can't believe this happened under our watch, and we can't believe that this is what, and the problem is that,
Oh,
we
Israel's
kind
out
of
of control. I
we
mean, it
went
was just
along with it. We went
insane.
along with it in the beginning, and then it just got out of hand, and then we just were like, oh my God, I mean, what have we done here? They almost looked apologetic. I mean, it was interesting to see,
They look like Dr. Frankenstein.
well, I wouldn't
It's
say that.
like we made a monster.
Yeah, but they were very candid, and I was so surprised because I mean these guys were at the highest levels and working with. I mean, I cannot believe that these guys would do that and risk their I guess their livelihood, or maybe they're all retired, but at least risk their safety. Because I mean, I'm certain look at the kind of idiotic ideological fanatics. These guys make Islamic fanatics look calm. These ideological Zionists that live in these settlements, when they talked about how they were looking for an example on how to basically rig and detonate the Dome of the Rock and basically blow it to smithereens. And these were crazy, fanatical Zionists, and then they put them all in jail and then freed them and say, okay, go back. And they said, now we had a new sort of radical target to keep an eye on. It wasn't just in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Now we had to watch these damn settlers because they were, if not more crazy, if they were as crazy, more crazy than some of the radicals that we were looking at.
The worst ones, like. There are,
well, that's what these Shin Bet guys were saying.
Yeah,
I mean I was like, my jaw hit the table. I was like, wow, they actually said what I thought was and here's the guys that would know better than us. I mean, we weren't on the ground. These guys spent their entire careers on the ground doing surveillance against these guys.
They were the ones saying it. Did you see the video of the settler that climbed up in a Palestinian's roof in Hebron and he got stuck in the barbed wire and couldn't get down?
Well,
this is my roof because it's on my land. God gave it to me, and you're just a Jordanian. Yeah, blah blah crazy. Blah. And the guy's like, you're stuck in barbed wire.
Yeah, but it's it just came as a shock to me. I mean, I hadn't seen that documentary till this week, and I got to tell you, I was watching that, just going, wow, that is something else. And by the way, if you do want to see the documentary, The Gatekeeper, please download it from Pirate Bay. It is free there. But
I didn't say that. You did. You can see the trailer on YouTube for free.
It is $12 if you want to watch it legally on, I think it was YouTube.
So. I think you should support.
You know what?
Like
for 12
that,
bucks,
you
no, because
it,
you know,
really,
you're right. You know, I mean, it was pretty damn.
I'm just saying.
It was a bit. I'm sorry. You're probably right. All my friends that are in the music and the movie business think I'm an asshole for saying stuff like that. So,
well,
I agree.
If you're dirt
poor,
go ahead and download it. But I mean, if you have the ability, you should support it as people when they make films like that, because it.
Of all the ones I've stolen, I gotta tell you, that's probably the one I feel the most guilty.
Yeah, especially after watching it, right? You're like,
especially after watching
it,
I was like,
anyway, even though I just
that was worth $12 actually. I want to know where that $12 goes first, and then you know what? I'll go back and pay for it. How about that?
Right.
Let me figure out who made that movie and what he's going to do with that cash, because that's the other thing. You know, I don't.
Well,
I certainly
always
don't
want to research where your money's going. Though.
Yeah, because I certainly don't want to give that money to anybody making Argo or Rosewater. Have you seen this movie Rosewater? Did I tell you about that?
I'm not going to watch that.
But you know what that's, you know what's going on there, right? Rosewater is the sequel to Argo. Rosewater will get an Oscar, and you'll see Jon Stewart up there doing his speech and basically throwing Iran into the mud again for no reason other than, once again, more anti-Iranian propaganda.
All these awards, whether it's Oscars or Nobel Peace Prizes or whatever, it's baloney. It's totally political. It's not
it's
based
baloney,
on
but
the best
unfortunately,
who's done the most for peace. It's just like,
nine times out of ten, when you're talking to Americans, we know what they're going to know about Iran. It's all going to be what they saw at the movie theater when they watched Argo. That's it. Yep. And that's going to be their level of expertise. Well, I saw Argo. Well, you're an expert. And that's sad, because the next movie they're going to see is based upon the book called And Then They Came For Me. And this kid, Mazier, his father was arrested by the Shah. His sister was arrested by Khomeini, and he was arrested by Ahmadinejad. And he was arrested during the Green Revolution.
Hey, so I'm sorry to cut it short, but we've gone over time. But I'll just have you back on. I'd love to continue to talk about Iran and Hollywood and the propaganda of Hollywood to continue this discussion about world oligarchs, really, not just in Russia, but It's nice to study a certain area to get your head around it, and then you can see how the system is implemented in other areas as well, because it's pretty much the same thing.
So, sadly, they're all working together, unfortunately, and we're just basically observers.
But thank you for your time, and I'll have you back on. We could talk forever. It just went by so fast, so quickly.
Nice. Thanks for having me, Ron.
Yeah, no problem. I'll talk to you later.
Ciao.